If you're looking for the perfect gift, you're covered with a gift that's sure to wow. Taste of Chicago ships Lou Malnati's legendary deep dish pizzas nationwide. Plus, they ship other Windy City favorites too. Visit tasteofchicago.com to order today.
So this is a guy who lives high on the hog, and he has this Tammany Hall style attitude to power. And it's the Chicago way, absolutely.
Look, the Chicago way is a deep cultural phenomenon.
It's the Chicago way.
The Chicago way, that's the focus.
In a tower by the river, there lived a man. There was a man who took a stand. With pen and paper in his hand, defeating foes in every ward with a pen more mighty than the sword. No escape from his ink lasso in a tower by the river, Castle.
Here's how you get him. He pulls a knife, you pull a gun. He sends one of yours to the hospital, you send one of his to the morgue. That's the Chicago way.
Type in Syria into your search engine, look at headlines, and you'll see a lot of disconcerting news. In Syria, U.S. hopes to avoid replay of Afghanistan, says the New York Times. Turkish foreign minister discusses with Blinken the need to cooperate with new Syrian regime, says Reuters. Syria's U.S.-backed Kurd coalition faces an uncertain future after the Assad ouster, says the left-wing National Public Radio taxpayer-funded news organization. And an outfit called The Cradle says Moscow warns U.S., U.K. preparing ISIS attacks on air bases in Syria. That's just 24 hours ago as we're recording. And I'm reminded, after all this and all that's going on and all the screaming and trying to entice us, the Syria's de facto leader says holding elections could take up to 4 years, and the new Syrian leader hopes Iran will reconsider regional intervention. The Times of Israel says Damascus governor says new Syrian regime wants peace. All of this coming as President Trump takes office. And I'm reminded of years ago when I was a champion of all things war and all things neocon, when I didn't have to fight, when I didn't have to send my kids to die, when I didn't have to send them to blow their bodies up. And a young soldier, American soldier, came to knock on the door and came to visit me and said, "Mr. Cass, I just want to talk to you for a moment because I read your stories about your columns about the rat in Iraq. And if you have a rat in your child's bedroom, you have to kill it," meaning Saddam Hussein. And he just looked at me and he said, "You know, it's all bullshit, right? All of it." And I was struck by that. A veteran soldier, four tours in Iraq and Afghanistan, telling me that it's all bullshit. And I said, "Why are you going back?" And he said, "I have kids to protect," meaning not his own children, meaning American soldiers. And that started a change in me. And now we're at the end, at the brink of it again, with more voices, more neocon voices demanding that we get involved. And I just thought we should all take a breath, because I've seen what President Trump issued, a statement like we shouldn't get involved, but there are going to be forces that are going to push us there. And I thought I should ask the one person I respect in foreign policy analysis, my brother Nicholas, who spent more than 30 years in the U.S. State Department and CIA and many other postings that we'll talk about. to ask him, what do you make of this push to get Americans involved? And what is the recent history so that people have context? Nick, welcome to the Chicago Way.
John, thank you very much. Hi, Jeff. How are you guys doing? Merry Christmas, and Merry Christmas to all your viewers, and Happy New Year as well.
Yeah, Nick, same to you. It's certainly been a busy month, internationally speaking, that's for sure, beyond all the domestic issues here. John, if you'd like, or I'd love to get Nick's take on what happened in Syria before we jump into the bigger picture and how the U.S. might be involved, because I don't think a lot of people understand what happened. And if possible, can you give us the 30,000-foot view?
Yeah, sure, I can, real quickly. First of all, it's good. I'm back here in Virginia visiting some friends for a week after being traveling a lot in the Middle East and the Balkans for the last month or so. I was in the Gulf and in Kurdistan and of Iraq and some other places. And so it's good to be here. And the thing that strikes me the most about America is that it's completely detached from the challenges that are that people out there face. And it's really important, I think, for people to really consider what they think they know, ask themselves how they know what they know, and to sort of do some digging before they come to blithe opinions about this, that, or the other thing, particularly when it comes to the Middle East. I've seen a lot of that on my Twitter feed and other places, and I think people need to be to do their duty as citizens by really kind of digging in, because this does affect us in one way or the other, or can affect us in ways that probably we very, very difficult to extricate ourselves from if we make the same kind of mistakes we've made over the past 20 or so years. But just briefly, in Syria, there has been the Syrian civil war for many years now. The Assad regime, which had been in charge of the country about 50 years, a very ideologically secularist and totalitarian force that ruled by intimidation and fear, was finally ousted over the course of many years, but particularly over the last month, by a number of groups, including the Turkish-backed Syrian National Army and the Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, which is an Islamist group. That seems to be the one that's the most prominent right now in Syria. But in any event, they ousted Assad. He fled the country. He's gone now. I think he's in Moscow. And they're set to try to rebuild the country. And the question is, who are these people and how are they operating? And there's a lot of fear and concern out in Syria, of course, and in other places, about what this means on the ground, given what had happened in 2014 with the rise of ISIS in the wake of the collapse of both Iraq and Syria, or parts of it therein, and the kind of horror show that happened there. So what I would say, based on some reporting that I am fortunate enough to be able to draw on, because I'm in touch with very, very well-placed people in the region, that right now it's obviously a lot of tension. There's some concern, but that there is the possibility of moving forward, and there's hope. And I think that that's really, really important. It suggests that whatever it is that's happening here is different from what happened 10 years ago. And I think what we've seen on the broader picture is the reemergence of Turkey as the major player in Syria. It's right on the border of Syria, as you know. There's a huge, long border of Turkey with Syria. And this is coming at the expense of both the Iranians and of the Russians, who had backed the Assad regime. And so I think that, in my opinion, the Turks have had some real civilizing influence on the dominant players now in the region. This is, again, not something that I think people can assume will go on forever. This is a very, very fraught and dangerous thing. And right now you're seeing efforts by a variety of people to try to promote instability and chaos, or promote political agendas that could lead to the dissolution of Syria, in which case, a lot of people are going to get hurt again in the ensuing chaos. And so I think it's in the interest of everybody, regardless of your political view, to first and foremost promote stability and in Syria, and to do that in ways that protect ancient communities that have been there, Christians, Jews, Muslims, others, and also to avoid, from the perspective of the United States, to avoid intervening in ways that will just make the situation worse. And that's a very, very tricky thing, because the United States is already kind of involved in Syria by supporting what we euphemistically call the Syrian Democratic Forces, or SDF, which is really the secularist terrorist Kurdistan Workers Party, or PKK, which is seen as anathema to the rulers of Syria now.
Nick, you a year ago or so, you wrote a piece for the American Conservative on our terrorist ally in Syria.
Yes.
And what was that about? It was about the PKK, right?
Yes, it was about how the United States created the euphemism, or the fig leaf of the SDF, to protect its or to obfuscate its support for the terrorist PKK in Syria. And if you're thinking about a country like Syria, where, you know, obviously it's a predominantly Muslim country, predominantly Sunni Muslim country, and you're thinking of the United States as having as its principal power avatar a secularist terrorist revolutionary group, you can't, it's hard to think of something that would be worse from our perspective. Now, you know, we have a tendency to back whomever for the moment. So ideology is often not a a component of our rationale in terms of what we're doing. When we don't think strategically, we ignore these kind of questions. But I think in the last 4 years in particular, and certainly under the Obama era, the fact of the PKK as coming from the same, shall we say, post-Marxist or neo-Marxist milieu that so many of our most woke people in the United States seem to support, was a factor in generating sympathy for this group in ways that I think kind of defy logic and common sense. And so this is why this is a challenge for us now, because we've been backing a group that is a threat to the territorial integrity of Syria, but also to Turkey, where it has been the primary security threat, this terrorist group. It's also a threat to the Kurdistan regional government in northern Iraq, where they look at the PKK as a revolutionary group that is fundamentally anti-Kurdish in its ideas, in the sense that just as the Soviets were anti-Russian in many respects, the anti-Russian culture in reality, the PKK, rooted in Marxism, you know, kind of looks at the Kurds as something that needs to be reformed completely. You know, a people who are should be, you know, whose culture and history should be wiped away clean to build the new Soviet man, or the new Kurdish man out of, you know, the detritus of the new world or modernity. So I think that there's a lot of danger here with respect to pursuing these kinds of relationships. We already have them. And so the challenge for us, I think, as America, is to how to extricate ourselves, but to do that in a way that actually enhances stability, because we have been involved for a long time. And I think we ought to, in our own interest, try to leave in a way that does not fuel chaos. Now, we've, you know, the Biden administration has been particularly bad at that, as we know. You know, Afghanistan was a horrific example of fundamental incompetence, I think, which will, you know, people will be talking about 100 years from now. And so we want to make sure that we can do this without that kind of a collapse. But I think essentially that's the issue that we have to confront, we have to deal with. You know, if we're interested in the survival of the Christians, for example, then we should not take steps that will actually harm these groups. We've done that, as we have done previously and in our history. And as you may recall, before the election, Vice President-elect J.D. Vance pointed out about how U.S. policy in Iraq had led to the destruction of the Christian communities there, the ancient Christian communities of Iraq. And so we don't want to continue to do the same thing that we've done before. And the irony would be, of course, that many people would use protection of the Christians as a rationale for the kind of military invention that we saw previously, intervention that we saw previously, and that would have exactly the opposite effect on what than the stated purpose of the intervention. So I think that we need to be really careful. We need to understand a little bit more, a little bit better what's actually going on the ground, trying to find ways to work with regional partners and to do that in a way that promotes stability first and foremost in Syria.
I mean, so Nick, because it's obviously a really complex situation.
Yeah.
The threat of conflict there is then conceivably, we're talking about being with those who have ousted Assad now, who seemingly have the military at their least was listening to them and, you know, let them kind of do their thing. And then the PKK, who I think it was going to maybe try to carve out the country a certain way. Where do we see, I mean, where would there be a spark? Where's the battle going to be from? Because there's just so many people involved. It's hard to understand where the lines are drawn.
Well, first and foremost, I think let's start kind of like in concentric circles.
Yeah.
The new powers in Syria have an obligation to make sure that their followers do not engage in the kind of indiscriminate violence and personal vendetta settling that we've seen in too many regions. And there does seem to be some indication of that, that there has been some of that that's been played up a lot, I know, on Twitter, but that also there seems to be some effort by the part of the new rulers to limit that, which is, again, I think, certainly not an ideal situation, but compared to the previous iterations of these groups in the region, I mean, it's a remarkable difference. I think it's clearly we can see that there's a difference, however we want to characterize them or however much we may, people may not like them. I think the very fact of the matter is they're behaving differently than ISIS did 10 years ago. So that's good, and that should be actually encouraged. Mm-hmm. And the best way to do that is to ensure that there is stability and that the there's not the perception that there are people tugging away and trying to undermine them, which of course, if that happens, will only lead to the kind of strife and internal recriminations and violence that we're trying to avoid. So I think the main thing is to first calm everybody down and not think about challenging or threatening things, trying to consolidate and to build constructively at this point is probably the best way to go forward, one. Secondly, I think that there are issues on the territorial integrity front. In the north, we have the Kurdistan Workers Party, the PKK, aka the SDF, which under the American umbrella has set up a de facto PKK statelet in the region, and they probably want to continue that because not only do they want a state in the region, but they also want to use that as a launching point for aggrandizement into Syria, or rather into Iraq and other places. I mean, they look at the Kurdistan region of Iraq, the government there, as a rival for Kurdish, for power and influence among the Kurds. And so this revolutionary force is not likely to stop in Syria, but can try to continue on elsewhere. So a very destabilizing thing it would be to have a PKK state in the area. Secondly, of course, it would, and perhaps even more importantly, it would threaten the security interests of Turkey, which is why Turkey has intervened a number of occasions since 2019 and before to try to establish or try to break up PKK power there and to establish a security zone. So the interest of the Turks would be to keep Syria whole and, of course, to expand Turkish influence as much as they could in a united Syria that was not breaking apart into centrifugal pieces, right? On the other hand, you have Israel in the south, which has been very, very strongly in favor of the quote-unquote Kurds in the north, meaning that they, you know, support diplomatically the PKK, the SDF, or however you want to describe it. There's also some question, I think, legitimately about whether Israel's agenda is to establish a temporary buffer zone in the region. As you know, they've been moving from the Golan into other areas in southern Syria on their border to try to head off or to forestall or preempt what they are worried about would be attacks on Israel, which is completely understandable in the context of a situation where Israel has confronted was confronted by the horrific terrorist attack on October 7, 2023, and has been taking steps to try to protect itself or to try to head off you know, attacks from other similarly situated powers or terrorist elements or whatever. The question, though, in that respect is to what extent the actual things that they're doing are wise or not. So maintaining an indefinite presence in Syria sounds like a potentially, you know, a long-term sort of situation, which could also contribute to the destabilization of Syria if it's continued. So we have to be very, very mindful of that.
Are you talking about quagmire, Nick? Quagmire?
I'm talking about a situation in which it may be, I mean, there is a budding regional competition between Turkey and Israel in the area. And the question is, which one of these, what's the form that's going to take? Is it going to take is it going to maintain itself on the level of rhetoric, or is it going to become something a bit more serious over time? The best way to prevent it from becoming serious over time is to insist on the territorial integrity of the country and people coming together and having meeting out agreements about how to proceed. So what has been encouraging is reports that the Turks are offering Israel the same kind of consultative mechanism on military operations and others that the Israelis had with the Russians a few years ago. So what that shows is that the Turks are trying to think about, okay, how do we avoid this from, how do we head this off, and how do we keep this from becoming a permanently destabilizing situation, which they certainly do not want, because Syria is on their border, as we say. And so, but then the question is going to be, what will the new powers in Syria do to ensure that there is no threat to Israel, and that there is no threat of a independent terrorist threat emanating from Syrian territory into Israel? So Israeli interests have to be satisfied, as do Turkish interests. And the way to do that, of course, is to talk about it in the context of a stable situation and not to take actions that lead to instability, which will make it harder and harder for people to put the situation back together in a way that satisfies everybody. So that's why I say it's a very, very sensitive moment. The longer we can maintain territorial integrity and reduce the impulse of people to tug away at the borders, whether it's from the PKK in the north or from Israel in the south, or whether it's the Turks themselves who decide that, under the circumstances, you know, we're going to have to stay here as we have been indefinitely. All of that would just create a much more chaotic, intense situation internally in Syria. That could lead, of course, to, you know, negative outcomes for the actual people who live there. And that's, I think, what people want to stop and should focus on primarily at this point.
There is an article I recommend to everyone listening. I published it at John Cass News. It's called "To Protect Christians and Everyone Else in Syria, Promote Equality and Territorial Integrity" by Dr. Nawaf Salameh. Dr. Salameh is a Romanian, and he is a Syrian Orthodox. Dr. Salameh says his community has been in Syria for millennia. "My extended family is there," he writes, "native to the Valley of the Christians. I remember talking to a Syrian Orthodox priest many years ago who told me of this Valley of the Christians when ISIS was rolling through and terrifying the Christian people there. They would put signs on the door, like signage in chalk, 'A Christian lives here.' And it was extremely intimidating. How have they been doing now? How is the Christian community in Syria? How are they surviving?"
Well, as I said before, they've endured a lot, particularly since the fall of the Ottoman Empire, actually, about 100 years ago. And in this most recent situation, one of the things that they've had to overcome is this idea that the Christian community supported the Assad regime. And, you know, one of the great things about what I get to do now for a living is that I have, as I may have mentioned earlier today, some very, very good connections to people who are on the ground all over Syria and other parts of the Middle East, and who have many, many stories about the dangers and the threats and the challenges they faced under Assad. And they faced the same kind of totalitarian predations that everybody else did. You know, the sort of seizure of people, the disappearance into the prisons, no news about them, people who were taken on the whim of the old establishment, on the whim of the people with a modicum of power in the bureaucracy. And there's pretty horrific stuff here. So they're happy to see Assad gone, and they're happy to see an opportunity for something new. And the question is, what is that going to be? And I think Dr. Salameh, who just a remarkable guy, it points out in his article, which is, I think, very, very important. First, two things. One, I mean, as a medical doctor, you know, he has this appreciation for Hippocrates. And so it's first, do no harm. Don't do things that are going to actually harm the situation and make it worse, regardless of what you think is your motivation. But secondly, to focus on what it is, what's the solution requires. And the solution requires, I think, some recognition on the part of everybody in Syria that we're all people of faith, and that faith should be respected, and that there should be equality on the basis of that, that every citizen should be an equal citizen, a full citizen of Syria. There should be no going back to the Class B citizenship of Christians in the Assad era. And that, thirdly, that you maintain the integrity of the country and don't create a spoils system like it has been created in other countries, where people say the Muslims get this, right, you know, the Christians get that, the Kurds should have this, whatever the sort of dispensation is, because that only intensifies the competition for scarce resources that inevitably starts to look like a religious conflict and fuels precisely the sentiment that we don't want. So treat everybody equally. Everybody should have their the respect of their faith, you know, drawing upon the best, actually. I mean, Syria is a predominantly Muslim country. So, you know, I would say as a Christian that it would be good if Muslims drew on the best parts of the Islamic tradition in this respect. And there's a reason why Christians survived for 2000 years or 2000 years and over 1600 years under Muslim rule.
Right.
So I think, and it's in part a consequence of Islamic thinking and discussion of these issues. I know we always focus on the negative parts of that, but there are a great deal of positive parts as well. But to make all of that happen requires concrete stability on the ground, because if you have stability and you don't have the threat that people are taking something from you, then you're more able to relax and to engage in the kind of behaviors, the tolerant behaviors that are the key to long-term survival. If what you're thinking about is someone stealing from you, you don't have a time to, you know, you're not really thinking about being nice. Right.
And self-interest takes over.
Yeah. I mean, self-interest, sort of warped by misperceptions.
And right. Wow.
That's another aspect of this that's really sort of important. And again, gets back to, I think, Dr. Salameh's point about Hippocrates and doing no harm, which is you don't want to become subjected and spun up by the kinds of reporting that is designed to promote a particular agenda or not. I mean, I remember a friend of mine was telling me that there were some reports that the new rulers of Syria were imposing the poll tax on Christians as if it was like a medieval situation or the ISIS era and this kind of thing. And of course, that spun everybody up. But I was assured by many people who were on the ground. And again, I'm the beneficiary of a very, very, very strong network of people out there who tell me that this was not happening. So there's an effort to, I think, spin people up and to drive the concern and have people stampeded into a corner, as you see on so many other issues across the political agenda of, you know, in the United States and elsewhere. I read a column the other day about a guy saying we should prepare to attack Turkey. And I think Jude Russo, your guest on the recent podcast, wrote an excellent reply about that, about how, you know, people should really cool it when talking about attacking, you know, NATO ally Turkey in the region, particularly given the lack of real alternatives to what's going on there. So, again, common sense, reason, you know, keeping a level head, all of these things are very, very important right now. And I think Dr. Salameh's column was a call for precisely that. And there's reason to expect and reason to hope that, that this can be achieved if people move together and try to avoid provocations and all of that's those sorts of traps that are often laid.
If you're a parent or taxpayer of the United States, why is this issue, in simple terms, why is this issue in Syria and the terrorist organization that Biden supported and Obama, the PKK, what is all this about and why should we be? I mean, I have my own views, but I want to know yours.
Yeah, my view is that we should not be involved in this way. I mean, and President Trump said correctly, it's not our fight. So the idea that we should be involved militarily is a, I think, another, as it would be a huge, huge mistake, right? That would have the same kind of negative consequences that we saw have seen up to date, up to now, and also basically since the beginning of the 21st century in Iraq and elsewhere. So we want to avoid getting involved in wars that we really don't understand and that aren't in our vital national interest. That said, we do have interests in Syria. We have an interest in stability. We have an interest, I think, as Westerners in the plight of the Christians, particularly given the damage that we've done inadvertently to them. So we have issues that we want to maintain. We have obviously an alliance with or partnership with Israel, and we want to make sure Israel is secure. We also you know, have to, though, put our own national interest above all of this. And our national interest is not to be suckered into another war in the Middle East. And
I know that if you ask if you ask people, most Americans, they look at Syria and they think, Christians? Really?
Yeah.
They don't. I wonder why. Is it the culture, Hollywood? Is it media where they don't? Can't even grasp many Americans, and I love my brothers and sisters in America, but they can't even grasp that there are Christians in the Middle East.
Yeah,
why is that?
Well, I think it's
very very upsetting.
Yeah, it's kind of a consequence of a parochial point of view that we were kind of and is a manifestation in some ways of the blessings of our country. You know, we're able to live in North America with two oceans on our side. Yeah. We don't really have to be as attentive to what's happening in that area as we ought to be, say, to the activities of the cartels across our border, right? So I think we're blessed by distance where such that our ignorance of those things is not a vital concern. Right. So and what that has meant, however, in practice is to the extent that we're getting involved in these areas, which are not our vital concern, our ignorance now becomes a problem for the region. It doesn't become a problem for us. We, you know, Iraq can be exploded or destroyed in the context of a war under false pretenses, say, and it really doesn't affect us directly. And so people can go about minding their, you know, doing their daily lives and obviously mourning for the loss of American soldiers. But there's no draft. There's not. It's not like a situation that you might pertain or might be the case if you were talking about something that was right on our border. It was a direct threat to the United States. So in this case, the ignorance can actually be harmful. And it's the repeated activity based on ignorance is going to have a repeated negative effect on our standing in the world. And it already has, I would say, in the Middle East. To the extent that that is important to us or important generally, it's not a good thing. So, it's a very interesting question, John, but I think it ultimately comes down to the fact that we haven't had to pay attention to these things because we've been blessed by our geographic situation.
Amen to that. I mean, just from a personal standpoint, I mean, it has been pretty nice not to see, you know, caskets coming home with flags draped over them every week like we were in most of my lifetime.
Well, and that's why, it's so important, I think, that President-elect Trump said, this is not our fight. Now, as you know, he tried to extricate himself, us, from Syria back in 2019 while I was at the National
Okay,
Security.
Let's get to it, because when he was trying to do that, he knew what was the problem. And what did General Milley and all those – I have to watch my language, but but basically I would say – what rhymes with something all, okay? Well, those generals dragged their feet, and he kept trying to push it, and they treated him as if he were the idiot, and he didn't. They didn't have to obey him.
Yeah, I mean, it was basically in the context of the resistance against President Trump and the Obama-led coup attempt and all of that. The Obama-instigated coup attempt back in that began with all that Russiagate hoax and all that stuff.
Yeah.
So all of that was brought to bear. I mean, these guys, look, they, you know, they have a vested interest or had a vested interest in maintaining the status quo. There were a lot of there's a lot of emotional, you know, baggage for particular elements of the military establishment who were out in Syria, who think that, for example, well, you know, you know, we are, you know, working with the Kurds, and so let's give them a state. You know, that's not their call. You know,
right?
It's not their responsibility to, or they're within their purview to determine what the grand strategy, the political strategy should be. But I've always thought that was a problem, and you know, we'll have to see where that comes. As a matter of fact, I'm looking at something right now.
I was just going to try. I think you might be the same. I don't know. I'm sorry, Nick. Just mentioning it. A headline just came across my phone here from Reuters saying that the jailed Kurdish separatist leader is supposedly talking about, you know, that peace is, it's time for peace. The peace is the next step. Yeah. I mean, that's amazing. That's you know, that's what we want, right?
It is. And again, that's all it's all due to Erdogan, who was being lambasted, the Turkish president Erdogan, who was being lambasted as a genocidal maniac in many quarters of Twitter because he's fighting against the Kurds, quote unquote. And what he's really fighting against, of course, is the PKK and the terrorist PKK. That kind of detail is very, very important. And yet it's routinely elided over. In order to make a to portray the situation as something else and to make a political point, which then puts pressure on Washington to continue staying the course even against its own interests. And I was actually thinking about this in the context of the article I wrote. Our terrorist ally in Syria. I'm trying to remember the title of my own piece. And
that's a good answer.
Yeah, right. And
Well, the damage that Obama has done to the world.
Well, it's not only Obama, though. I mean, I think Obama set in motion a number of things, but it was perpetuated by an establishment which also pushed him around as well. So, I think the real problem is frankly the deep state that I've written about, and I invite people to go look up my things there as well. But there was a line in the article on the PKK issue that I wrote that I'd like to read if I can.
Please.
And it says, continuing to foster PKK power by maintaining the relationship as the available tool by which the U.S. demonstrates relevance in Syria is self-defeating, not least because it aligns Washington with a set of interests and an ideology that are anathema to American interests, important state actors, including Turkey and peoples of the region. The longer it's continued, the more deeply the already romanticized and clientelist relationship with the SDF and its components settles in among the U.S. military, political, bureaucratic, and media machinery, the more ingrained the perception in the U.S., the more ingrained the perception of the region that the U.S. seeks to impose a hostile and alien ideology in the service of revolutionary and social and political change. So we're aligning ourselves with interests that are ultimately contrary to American interests. And I think that that's why we need to be very, very careful and stop contributing to the process of instability and chaos. I mean, the support for the SDF has been portrayed as a stabilizing factor, but it's actually created precisely the instability and chaos that we saw in Syria and that the new rulers of Syria have overcome. And what they have said is the PKK, the SDF, will not be allowed to stay in this country. that they're going to have to, people are going to have to integrate into the Syrian military now. And
speaking of the deep state, Nick.
Yeah.
You spent 31 years with the Department of State, U.S. Department of State, with CIA in the White House, National Security Council, National Intelligence Council, all sorts of postings.
Yeah.
And now people want to know, are you going to leave the private sector and go back to work in the government where you're needed? Or will you continue to, you know, live a good life like a pasha and enjoy your time with your family?
Well, as I've said before, and I'll say again, I enjoy the private sector. I enjoy working with the Nawaf and the company. And it's been a wonderful experience. It's been great for everybody. Of course, if something comes up, I'll obviously listen. But I'm enjoying the life in the private sector right now, John.
Well, that would make all of us, all the castes, happy.
Because, well, I don't know about all of them, but
maybe not you. But
well, no,
we don't. We just want you to be safe. You know, we love you, and we want you to be safe.
Well, thanks. Yeah, and, that's great. Romania is great. It's got its problems, as you know, but it's great.
Well, I'm a little divided on Romania because I don't like the meech culture. I liked the meech culture at one point because I thought, I can't wait to get into this food culture of meech.
Yeah.
But really, I don't like it. No offense, Romanian people. I don't want to be, don't be angry at me.
What are you talking? I have no idea what you're talking about. Enlighten me, John. What's meech? What's that mean?
Meech. Nick, I'd let Nick explain meech.
Meech are like a cross between a kefteva and an Adana kebab, if you can put it that way.
Okay.
In which is a Romanian delicacy of pork and meat, as they say, or beef mixed together, often with some baking soda and various spices. And what you do is you cook these things on a grill, and then you eat them with copious amounts of bread and mustard and beer. And it's nice. Like the working man's lunch. And it's an interesting sort of thing. But yeah, you can't eat too many of them, as even Romanians will tell you. It's you can't exist exclusively on them. But there are other things that they have, as you know, from your time here. You know, pork.
It's a wonderful, wonderful country. Yeah, wonderful country. It is.
You'll have to come back out. You too, Jeff.
I will. I will come back out. And this time I might write about it.
Oh, that'd be fantastic. That'd be fantastic. But it's interesting. I mean, it is. There are some, as you guys know, I tweeted about it a while ago. But there's a political crisis going on right now because they've basically postponed the presidential election. They interrupted it, couple weeks ago, when it looked like an anti-establishment candidate was going to win. And the argument has been, well, this was the result of Russian meddling. Other people, I think many increasingly people, even on the liberal side of the equation, are saying that, the evidence for that is not as robust, shall we say, and that there are actually other factors involved which are problematic and haven't been addressed since the old days. So we're in this a bit of a quandary here. And I know the Biden administration has supported the official view, but folks from Mar-a-Lago have been tweeting out that this is, obviously very, very a bad sign for Romanian democracy. And, we're hoping that, we can get past this and get to that election and have it decided once and for all, which, who's going to win. So, but yeah, it's a challenging time here in Romania, or in Romania generally, especially at the moment. So we'll see where that
goes. I love it how the deep state, no matter where it is, what country, will look at something and say, this is a crisis. And the only way to protect us from crisis is to A, censor everyone that we disagree with, and B, increase the federal power.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, that's and that is a you know, it's amazing the extent to which I think liberal people who consider themselves liberals have justified this kind of stuff in the interest of supporting democracy. That was the big failing, or one of the big failings of the Biden administration. And it's just patently ridiculous. You can't save democracy by destroying it, you know. So, as I've written about in other contexts as well. So,
you know, if you're ever concerned about Biden and democracy, and the Washington Post and the New York Times and all of them guarding democracy, just look at those images of the photographs that came out recently of Joe Biden and Hunter having drinks with Xi Jinping and all the Chinese intelligence operatives who were their partners.
Yeah. It's kind of like putting, what was that? There was a group in Chicago, the good government group. What was it called?
Yeah.
Ethics. Ethics.
The group, it was called the Coalition for Better Government. It was run by a guy, named Dominic Longo, who I think, if I'm not mistaken, had a run-in with the federal authority because he was accused of vote fraud.
Yeah. Dun, dun, dun.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, I remember once I was asked years ago about my, you know, what are my experiences with respect to like these totalitarian regimes, this authoritarian regimes and this kind of stuff. And I said, well, you know, I was born and grew up around Chicago. And everyone laughed, and I was like the only one not laughing.
That's
so great. Yeah, weird stuff, huh?
Yeah. Strange weird times. Stuff. And real quick, just for the transparency, Dr. Salome is your boss, right, Nick?
Yes, my friend and my boss. He is the owner of the Nawaf Salome Family Office and the Alexandrian Group. I am the executive director for the Alexandrian Group and Nawaf Family Office. And it's been one of the great benefits to me because I consider myself still a student. So I'm always learning about things. And to be able to be to work with him has been just an extraordinary experience, particularly given, you know, not only the kind of intellect he has, but also the nature of his businesses and the connections. It's just extraordinary. And he was raised in Syria, raised and educated, a Christian in the Valley of the Christians in Syria, so speaks fluent Arabic. Came to Romania as a college student, studied medicine, learned Romanian, took his board tests in Greek, so learned Greek in the meantime, and is a fluent Greek speaker, and conducts his business in English. So, I mean, I'm, you know, and my office is right next to his. And so every day I'm hearing, you know, 7-8 languages being spoken down the hall, you know, whether it's, you know, obviously Greek, Romanian, English, Arabic, Turkish, Kurdish, you know, French, Spanish. I mean, it's just really an amazing experience. Even as someone who spent my life in the service of the United States and foreign policy, the environment at our office is pretty extraordinary. So yeah, and you know, like I say, he obviously cares deeply about Syria, loves his homeland, loves Romania, his country where he served in the military, and you know, has been his home for the last 43 years. And I think his approach and understanding of these issues is really, really something that people should consider, because I think a lot of folks are, you know, trying to either conceive of them in terms of what the, the particular political agenda is of my side or the other side or this or that. But like I always say in foreign policy, the first thing is not to consider what the interests of the United States are. The first thing to consider when you're making policy for the United States or anybody else is to first consider what's going on the ground. What's the actual ground truth? What's happening there? And once you understand that, then you can figure out what's really in your interest, what's not in your interest, whether or not we should pursue something there, or what else we can generally do. So the first order of wisdom is to understand what's going on the ground. And I'm really, you know, it's been a real pleasure and an honor to work at a company where that is also very much the ethos of everything that we're doing. So Like I would say to all the people who are like listening here, and to those who are, on Twitter or whatever, first put aside what your preferences are. Don't turn things, like Dr. Salome says, avoid turning this into a caricature, a simple caricature. Look clearly as you can about what's actually happening on the ground, regardless of your perspective and your preference. Then, once you've done a good analysis of things and have tried to be as objective and as clear as possible, then you can start to think about how this suits your interests or doesn't. If you do it the other way, chances are you're going to be making a lot of big mistakes, and we've had enough of that for the entire 21st century, I'd say.
Nicholas Cass, wisdom from my brother. Thank you for that, Nick.
Thanks, Nick.
Pleasure, guys.
Nicholas Cass is the longtime U.S. State Department diplomat, CIA officer, intelligence officer, number of postings in the White House, the National Security Council, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And now he's here on the Chicago Way. So thanks for joining me, Nick, and Jeff Carlin, executive producer of the WGN Radio. And me, I'm John Cass, editor of John Cass News, where you always get a good cup of Midwestern common sense. I'd really like you to subscribe to John Cass News, $50 a year, $5 a month. I am not, after all, as Don Barzini says, I am, after all, we are not communists. And a man should be able to charge for his labor. And I'd like to take a moment to pray for you and thank you all. We had a good or interesting 2024, and let's have a excellent 2025. Let's be kind to one another. Join us again, won't you, for another edition of the Chicago Way podcast on WGN+.